An American biologist who is the president of Stanford University's Center for Conservation Biology compared statistics on population growth and food supplies. And the results, what he came up with, was not very pleasant. It looks rather bleak, in fact. He came to the conclusion that inside the next two decades, hundreds of millions of people will starve in spite of any crash programs we might embark upon to curtail the approaching crisis. Inside of two decades. You know how quickly two decades goes by. He said if the optimists are correct, today's level of misery, as he describes it, will be perpetuated for perhaps two decades into the future. Perhaps two decades, he says. But if the pessimists are correct, possibly within the next decade or maybe decade and a half, these things will occur. Massive famines will occur. So far, he said, most of the evidence seems to be on the side of the pessimists. In addition, being a biologist, he understands something about the effects of pesticides that we've been using for all these years on the human body. He predicted that within that window of about a decade and a half or so, up to two decades, life expectancy for people in the United States would drop to about 42 years because of the toxic effects of the pesticides that have been pumped into our environment. And in about 30 years, the population will plummet to about 22.6 million. All this is due to the massive famines, the toxins in the environment, and the other related factors. Now, can you imagine what it would be like if people began fighting for food during such a time? Can you imagine what it would be like if you add earthquakes to the equation? You think about the people in Haiti, and of course, our hearts go out to them. We know that they were already a suffering people, and yet now this devastation of an earthquake. Can you imagine what it would be like for us and other parts of the world if you had something like an earthquake, a devastating earthquake, or perhaps international strife in a time when we couldn't even feed ourselves? Well, it seems that the future looks rather bleak, according to this particular biologist. It reminds me of when Jesus was asked about the sign of his coming and of the end of the age. He said in Matthew 24, verses 6 and 7, he said, "And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars." Certainly we've heard of our share of those. "See that you are not troubled, for these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences." It seems that pestilences are always associated with famines, "and earthquakes in various places." It would appear that the time of the end is upon us, would it not? We've heard about it for years. We've read about it for years. You know, we thought it was going to happen back in the 70s. There was a time some of us, if we're old enough, would remember a time in about 1936. Some thought it would happen. There have been many predictions since then, but it would appear from these predictions here that the time is upon us. But wait a minute, I suppose it would be helpful if I gave you some dates. You see, the biologist who made all these predictions, his name is Paul Ehrlich. Ever heard of him? He's author of The Population Bomb and other essays and material he wrote on this subject back in 1968 and 69. You see, these things were supposed to happen by no later than 1985. And what actually did happen was we got wealthier, we got fatter, because we consume more calories, and things got in many ways better. Not everything got better, but in many ways they did. Certainly, we did not have massive famines. And certainly, the population and the food supplies didn't run into odds with each other and result in outbreaks of fights and famines and all these other terrible things that he predicted would happen. So as it turns out, Ehrlich's predictions were not a little off. They were dead wrong. I remember those days. I remember I was enrolled in college at the time, and I was taking one of those CRIP courses, as we called them back then. You could earn a few extra hours by taking. It was environmental science, and Paul Ehrlich's book was one of the ones that we were to read. And I remember that I had a copy, and there was this young lady in the class who was always very studious, and very attentive in class and had lots and lots of questions and comments when the class was going on. Unlike me, I was probably dozing here and there. But I remember seeing over there one day, she was all buried in that book. She was just reading and reading. And I remember she said, "Ew!" It was just overwhelming, these things that were predicted that were to come to pass in the near future. But they didn't. They didn't happen. Today we have diseases such as swine flu that pop up from time to time, and they scare us to death when we hear about relatively few people dying from it here and there. But then we hear the reports that most people who get it will not die, and that in fact the regular flu takes more lives than the swine flu. So we hear about those things, but it seems that medical science stays on top of a lot of those, not all those things, but a lot of those things. And if you compare that, if you compare today's struggles and problems, so far as our health concerns are concerned and disease outbreaks, at least in this country, this doesn't necessarily apply to every place on earth, but if you compare us with humankind in past centuries, then we can't even begin to relate to some of the things, or imagine some of the, we can imagine it, I suppose, some of the things they had to endure. When you have plagues, you know, something like the bubonic plague, wiping out major percentages of populations, then you've got a much bigger problem to deal with. And this in the midst of people going hungry, and in the midst of wars going on, and sometimes they go on and on and on. They had, in many ways, you know, they had it a lot worse than we have it today. No question about it. And yet each generation, it's interesting, isn't it? Each generation talks about how worse it is now than it used to be. Boy, things are really getting bad. Now, how could they get any worse? Oh, just go back to the Middle Ages, if you could. Or in fact, as far as that goes, you could go around various places in the world today, and you could see something far worse than anything probably most of us have ever experienced. I think you can see what I'm driving at here. Anytime a document is published that points to a bleak future, it's awfully easy to plug the claims in that document into a prophetic scenario or a prophetic timetable and then begin to announce that the end is near. We've seen it done before, time and time again. We will see it done again, no doubt. If you watch the TV evangelists and if you read some of their material, you'll see it done, being done right now. 1999 was the date of Christ's coming, according to Jack Van Impe at one point. Now it's 2000. I've forgotten the latest date, but he's had a series of them. You have to keep on having more dates because it keeps failing. That's just the way it is. But when the forecasters of doom and gloom or speaking, you know, sometimes you see these trends, you think, okay, this may well relate to what the things we read about in the Bible. But, you know, when the forecasters of gloom and doom are speaking in terms of what to expect in the next 10 to 15 years, I would say that's pretty close to date setting, wouldn't you? You know, we say, well, we can know the general time. Well, maybe so. But when you start naming years and what's going to happen in the next 4 to 7 years or the next 10 to 15 years, well, you know, we really don't know for sure what's going to happen, do we? Paul Ehrlich definitely didn't know what was going to happen back in 1968 or 1969. There's a website known as A Brief History of the Apocalypse. It's an interesting one. It doesn't seem to be all that friendly toward Christianity, so I'm not necessarily recommending it, but it does have a lot of interesting data. It traces, gives you an overview of all the date setting and the apocalyptic movements that have existed down through history, not only in Christianity, but in other religions and other philosophies as well. For example, just give you a brief rundown of some of them. We'd be here all day if I gave you the whole list. I mean, you could spend the whole time back in the first millennia, the first millennium of Christianity. And then after the year, all the way up to the present, you know, from the year 1000 up to 2000, there are so many more. And then around the time 2000, you know, the Y2K disaster that was predicted, there were all kinds of things. Anyway, I'm going to give you just a brief overview of some of them. In the second century, the Montanists believed that Christ would come again within their lifetimes. and that he would establish the New Jerusalem in Phrygia, right there in Asia Minor. They picked out the place. They knew where it was going to be, and they knew the time when he was going to come. It didn't happen, of course. As you know, it didn't happen. But yet, you know, interestingly enough, that movement continued on for several centuries. You look at other similar groups, you know, some groups who emphasize prophecy or those who emphasize apocalypticism, I would prefer to call it, such as Jehovah's Witnesses. They have a history of that. Seventh-day Adventists, in fact, the whole Adventist movement, including, unfortunately, the Church of God, has quite a bit of that. And if you look at if you look back at those histories, look at Jehovah's Witnesses, for example, you will find many dates that were supposed to be prophetically important, and it turned out to be not so important after all. Things that were predicted to happen didn't really happen during those times. In the 4th century, Hilary of Poitiers predicted the world would end in A.D. 365. Of course, it didn't. In the late 4th century, Martin of Tours wrote, "There is no doubt that the Antichrist has already been born." You heard that before? Well, that was going on a long time before you were born, all the way back at the latter part of the 4th century. He's firmly established already in his early years, he says. He will, after reaching maturity, achieve supreme power. And then the AD 500 was an interesting year for events that were supposed to occur. The Roman theologian Sextus Julius Africanus claimed that the end would occur 6,000 years after the creation. Where did I hear that before? 6 millennial days? Now, it seems that everybody comes up with a different date for the end of that period. He assumed that there were 5,531 years between creation and the resurrection, thus expecting the second coming to take place no later than A.D. 500. Hippolytus believed, another theologian who died in about the year 236, believed that Christ would return 6,000 years after the creation. He anticipated the parousia, the second coming, again in 500, the year 500. Irenaeus, following Hippolytus, or Hippolytus, however his name is pronounced, also believed that 500 was the year, A.D. 500 was the year of the second coming. Well, there's a very long history of apocalypticism. Like I said, we could be here all day talking about it. And, of course, failed predictions, one after the other. Now, they may look good at the time. There may be certain signs, what appear to be signs, that point to the return of Christ, or they seem to point to the return of Christ. Because in many of these apocalyptic movements, there were, in fact, famines and disease outbreaks and wars and all these other things going on at the time. And a lot of people were dying as a result of it. And it appeared that things couldn't get any worse. So there was a long history of it. And sometimes people came up with ideas just based on the date. You know, when the year 1000 rolled around, there's some controversy over what actually happened in the year 1000. Some say that there were crises going on, and that led people to do all kinds of crazy things like release all the prisoners. Hey, might as well let them go. They're about to face the judge. You know, let them go. And they had to go back and round them up and a year later, or try to round them up. Whether all that is true or not, we're not absolutely certain, because, you know, history gets a little blurred when things are exaggerated. There may be some exaggeration. Some believe that many people during that period didn't really know what year it was. So the year 1000 wouldn't necessarily mean anything. But those who did know and who read about the 1,000 years might link it all together. But it does. Evidently, there was a great deal of anticipation for the second coming in the year 1000. And evidently, they did do some things like release prisoners and release debts and that sort of thing. Later try to reverse all that. But on and on it goes down through the centuries. Well, let's bring it down closer to home. The doomsayers are still at work. I'll give you a few examples here. Larry Wilson, all of this is on the same website. Larry Wilson of Wake Up America Seminars predicted the second coming, quote, around 1998. The tribulation was supposed to start in 1994, 1995, and during this period, an asteroid was to hit the Earth. If it did, I just don't remember it. I don't think it did. Others thought 1998 was the year of the rapture. Donald B. Orsden, in his book, The Holy Bible, The Final Testament, What is the Significance of 666, said, take your supercomputers, your scientists, and feed the number 666 into them. The output will be the proof God gives that 1998 is the year Jesus will take the faithful with him. And then in Ominous Portents of the Parousia of Christ by Henry R. Hall, the author predicts that the world will end in 1998 because, among other things, get this, you add the number 666 to 666 to 666, it equals 1998. Wow. So the rapture was to take place in 1998. And then on September 25th, 1997, Hal Lindsey predicted on his TV show, International Intelligence Briefing, which has since been canceled now, it's the Hal Lindsey show, that Russia would invade Israel within 18 months. Now, this is the way it's reported on this website. I've read much of Lindsey's material, and usually he's a little more careful than that. He puts it in such a way so as not to be absolutely dogmatic, but he really wants to use that. You know, it's probably more like presented as speculation. It very well may be that in 18 months, well, it may be not in 18 months too, you know, but that's what he usually does. Then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, televangelist Jack Van Impe has suggested several dates for the second coming of Christ. One was 1999, and I don't remember what the current one is. It's likely to be wrong, just as the previous ones were. And the predictions for the year 2000 are just too numerous to name. There are so many of them. A long list of them, and you'll find them on the same website. I would like to give a summary statement that the person who has this website said, though. This is kind of a humorous statement about that. He said, January 1st, 2000, Jesus did not descend from the heavens. President Clinton did not declare himself dictator for life. The Antichrist did not rise to power. Nuclear missiles were not launched. Aircraft did not fall out of the sky. The global economy did not collapse. Terrorist bombs did not explode. The power did not go out. My computer still works. What we did have were some huge parties, spectacular fireworks displays, a Barry Manilow concert, head-splitting hangovers, lots of confetti to clean up, and some embarrassed survivalists who had spent their New Year's holed up in armed fortresses when they could have been partying in Times Square. Well, let's review some of the basics of biblical prophecy and get a clear understanding of why apocalypticism, this particular approach to prophecy, simply doesn't work. It's not the correct approach. It's not even the point of prophecy. When people go around trying to predict the time of Christ's return, well, what if you were right? I mean, but you know, a good chance, there's a stronger chance that you're going to be wrong. So that's not even the purpose of biblical prophecy. I'd like to go back and review some material. We've looked at this before, but it's very basic. And I think at least we can get a good overview of what the real purpose of prophecy is. Look at Matthew chapter 24 with me. Matthew chapter 24. And let's go right over to verse 32. Jesus has been describing these things. The question was, what is the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And Jesus describes a number of things. I think you know them all. He talks about wars, rumors of wars, famines, and earthquakes, and so on. As we mentioned earlier, he mentions the Great Tribulation, other things that are described here. And then he says, let's look at it in verse 32. He says, now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know the summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it, or some translations say he, it could go either way, I suppose, is near at the doors. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. Now, you know, the normal reading of this term, this generation, if you're talking to somebody and they says, you know, these things are going to happen in this generation, you normally don't think in terms of a future generation. It's right then and there. You think that generation or this present generation. So some have, of course, looked at this and said, well, he's talking about this generation in which all these things are occurring. And, you know, you get into some problems with this because if you go back and look at some of those things, or all of those things, from the earthquakes and the famines and the wars and the rumors of wars and everything else he mentions there, and all kinds of times of tribulation, in times when plagues are wiping out huge portions of populations in various areas, then it seems to me that if I were living that, I would say, I'm seeing these things. The leaves are about to put forth, the buds. You know, summer is near, as it were. It seems to be. And of course, that's what people have done down through the years. And we've done it ourselves in the past when we would look at the condition of this world and we would think at least that we were seeing this. But is that really what he's talking about? Is he talking about the very time of the end? I'm not, by the way, I'm not going to answer that question for you. I'm going to answer it yourself. I just want to give you this statement in its proper context. You know, back in the beginning of this section, it says back in verse 3, in fact, if you want to go back there, Matthew 24, verse 3 says, "Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be?" What things? What things is he talking about? Well, the things that he's just been describing. And what has he just been describing? If you read chapter 23, you see these very scathing remarks against the scribes and the Pharisees. He calls them hypocrites and snakes and vipers and children of hell and all kinds of choice terms because they were a sinful people. They were hypocrites. And he says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I would have gathered you as a hen gathers her chickens, her chicks, but you were not willing." And then he says, "You see the building of these buildings." The disciples pointed out to him the magnificent building of the temple, and he said that it's all coming down. And so the question is, when will these things be? What things? Well, that the destruction of the temple and the things associated with it. And the second question is, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? That's two questions. Now, we know, as a fact of history, that the temple was destroyed in AD 70 by the armies of General Titus. We know that the armies did encircle Jerusalem, as Luke's gospel mentions. And we know that that event happened. Now, there's another key here I want you to turn your attention to. And that's in chapter 24 here, and go to verse 36. This is an important key. He says, "But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven," and some manuscripts read, "nor the Son," meaning himself, "but my Father only." Now, think about that for a moment. Did Jesus know the day and hour of his coming? No. It may mean also he didn't know the day and the hour of the destruction of Jerusalem. He just knew it would be in this generation, whatever that means, however you define that. So it seems to me that Jesus, since he didn't know, it seems plausible that he didn't know how far apart these two events would actually be. The destruction of Jerusalem, which looking back we see when it happened, AD 70, or the temple that is, the siege on Jerusalem. And you can read about that in Josephus' Wars, something very horrible, very horrible. When people had to turn to cannibalism, you know, while they were under siege, the food supplies ran out, eventually started feeding on dead bodies and that sort of thing. It was just an awful situation. It was tribulation, to be sure. And, you know, and the end result was the Romans came in. They did the abomination, an abomination of desolation of sorts was standing in the holy place. They did destroy the temple. They did take the gold and so on. All these things did happen. So it seems to me, I think it would be plausible to say that since Jesus himself didn't know the hour, the day or the hour of his coming, and that means simply he didn't know the time of his coming, he wouldn't have been able at that point in time to separate the destruction of the temple from his second coming. He didn't know how much time would pass between those two. And I suppose that if I were a disciple and hearing these things, these descriptions, I would put them together. I would assume that the destruction of the temple meant the beginning. And that's what they were asking about. But now, looking back, we know a great time transpires between those two events. So when we read Matthew 24, we must keep in mind that some of the statements there pertain to the second coming. I think that's very clear. And some of them pertain to the AD 70 event. The problem is, it's sometimes hard to sort them out. If they couldn't have sorted them out at the time, then perhaps we can do it because we have a little more history. So when you read through Matthew 24, I'm going to give you an example of how applied to either the AD. That's a very familiar text right there in the midst of Matthew 24. Verse 15 says, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." By the way, it doesn't mean you're supposed to go over to Judea so you can flee into the mountains. I actually heard that suggested by someone one time, that how the church was going to be, when come time to flee, we're going to flee over to Judea, go right into the place Christ said get out of, and then when the time comes, we'll flee from Judea into the mountains to Petra. Well, I never really bought into that scenario, but it was kind of interesting when I was hearing it. "Let him who is on the housetop not go down, take anything out of his house, and let him who is in the field not go back to his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant, to those who are nursing babies in those days, and pray that your flight be not in the winter, on the Sabbath." He's talking about, remember, not getting out of Kansas, not getting out of Tyler, but Judea. "For then there will be great tribulation such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be." Now, on the one hand, we could go to other scriptures and show that there is tribulation associated with the time of Christ's second coming. But on the other hand, we can also look back at history and see that that AD 70 event, 66 through 70, interestingly enough, a 3.5-year period, was a time of great tribulation. The question is he talking about that event here, this text here we just read, is he talking about the past event or is he talking about a future event? To me, especially when you compare it to Luke 21, you know, you look at Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, you see the same essential things being described, but you will notice there are some little differences along the way. Here's the way Luke put it. Luke 21, he didn't talk like Matthew and Mark did. He says, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near." Is he talking about the same thing or not? You know, some people have said that, well, it perhaps that in the process of discussing these things, describing these things, the different said, but no writer took down everything he said, that he talked about both events. And some would say this one in Matthew 24 refers to the future, and Luke was talking about the AD 70 event. That's possible, I suppose. But the point is, it's not always real easy to sort it out and determine which pericope, that's a block of text, a subject, a paragraph, which a particular block pertains to which event. We know that some of it's clear. When it says, you know, you see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven, I think that one's pretty clear. It's talking about the second coming. Some of these other things, though, become a little bit unclear. And when he says, "Learn the parable of the fig tree," my question is this. Is he talking, when he says, when you see all these things, does he mean all these things leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem? Or does he mean all these things leading up to the second coming? Again, it's not crystal clear. It may be to some people, or some of us may think it's crystal clear, but we might have some surprises in store at some point in time. I'm just simply saying that it could go either way. Now, we don't lose anything here. We do know that the AD 70 event happened, and Jesus spoke of it. He prophesied it. I think that's very important to understand. He said he prophesied it before it happened. Clearly, talked about it before it took place. His prophecy was very accurate. Not very accurate, it was 100% accurate. Happened just like that. And we also know he talks about his second coming, and we also know from other texts that there is a time of tribulation surrounding the second coming. So it really doesn't matter how we take these individual texts. But if we begin to construct a prophetic scenario, look at events that are going on, and then read them into it, we're going to make some mistakes. We're not going to get it right, ever. It's not, and I don't think that's the purpose of prophecy. Another important key here is, and I want to focus on a couple of parables that are part of the same Olivet. Another important key here is in verse 44. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in an hour you do not expect. Now, this is the key to understanding the next two parables. If you don't have that key, you're going to miss the point, I think. The first parable is the parable of the faithful and the unfaithful servants. Let's go ahead and read it in verse 45. It says, who then is the faithful and wise servant made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly, I say unto you, that he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat his fellow servants with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, in an hour that he is not aware of, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So what is the point here? What is the lesson here? Well, of course, one lesson would obviously be you don't want to be the evil servant. You want to be a good servant. You want to be faithfully carrying out the duties your master has left to you. But a main point here of this parable is, must be understood in light of verse 44, the key that I pointed to. The main point is, or a main point is, that Christ might return sooner than you think. And that would apply to any particular generation. It applies to us now. He may come. I can look back at the history of false predictions, of failed predictions, and I can say, well, I guess another 200 or 300 years might pass. Well, maybe, but, you know, he might come very quickly. And what he's saying is, you be ready for that. You live your life as if the parousia was going to take place tomorrow. Because it might. I don't know if it'll be tomorrow, but, you know, in the near future. In the near future, put it that way. It may be that some of the things we think are going to happen prophetically will happen a whole lot quicker than we think they're going to happen. And there he is. So we live our lives as if he were going to come tomorrow. And after all, who knows? We don't have tomorrow. None of us have tomorrow guaranteed, do we? And then the second parable is interesting. And you have the same key to interpreting this parable. It's the parable of the 10 virgins. I'm just going to summarize it for you rather than read the whole thing, read it all the way through. But in this parable, you know, there were 10 virgins. They were waiting the coming of the bridegroom. He was not, some people think, well, he was going to marry all 10 of them. No, they were part of the wedding procession. This is not an encouragement toward polygamy. That's not what's going on here. Some have used it this way. No, they were part of the wedding procession. They were going to be, in other words, a part of the party. And when the bridegroom came, it may mean he came out of the chamber where the marriage was going on. It's not real. It could go any number of ways. But the point is, they were awaiting him. Five of them were foolish. They didn't take enough oil with them. The other five had enough oil. And then when the bridegroom came and the procession began going back to the place where they were all going together, then the five foolish virgins didn't have enough oil to make the journey, to have their lights, keep their lights lit. They wanted to borrow some, couldn't do that. And, of course, when they were then, finally they were shut out. They couldn't be a part of the party, as it were. Well, some people would look at that and say, oh, look at all the lessons here. Oil represents the Holy Spirit, and if you don't have enough Holy Spirit, you're not going to make it. That's not his point here at all. That's not it. Oil is one of those incidentals along the way. I don't know that it represents anything other than oil. But his point is this. be prepared in the event of a long delay. Just because he doesn't come as soon as you think he's going to come, you be prepared anyway. So you see how these two parables back to back are interesting in that one says, be prepared for a sudden, quick coming. And the second one says, be prepared for a long delay. And what's the end of the matter? Well, it's in verse 13. He says, watch therefore. And by the way, the word watch doesn't mean watch world events. I'm all for watching world events. I watch world events all the time. I read news magazines. I watch TV. I watch the news, certain news. Some of it I get so tired of. You know, I can only take so much. But we do watch world events. That's not what this is about. Watch. It means be vigilant. It means be in a continual state of preparedness. No matter what's going on around you, it says, watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. That's the point of these parables. And this is what his teaching is leading up to. If Jesus himself didn't know, at that time at least, the day and the hour, and then the disciples didn't know, then we can't expect them to give a detailed scenario on when it will be, can we? And we don't know either. We don't know. And any guess that we do, you know, if any of us here set dates, every one of us could set a different date, and that just about would guarantee that he's not coming on either any of those dates. We're all going to be wrong. Now, what about our time today? Aren't things much worse? Isn't it true that we've become like Sodom and Gomorrah where moral decadence is concerned, and the Bible talks about that? Isn't that true? Isn't it true that we're seeing an escalation of crime with murders on the increase and moral depravity breaking out all out of previous boundaries? Isn't that true? It would seem so when you look at watch television, what's showing on prime time now. That I remember when I was a kid, I couldn't imagine seeing some of the things that are there. Back then, those would have been considered R-rated, or maybe even in some cases X-rated. But now they're prime time. Well, it's true that those things are out there. It's true this is the age of the Internet, and you know what's available there. And it's true that in some of the higher institutions are encouraging perversions of all of various sorts, and things that a few decades ago would have been criminal are now said to be okay. So all that is true, but is it really true that things are a lot worse now in that regard than they were in other times? I'd like to read from a section from this book. It's by Michael Medved. It's entitled The 10 Big Lies About America. I want to read from chapter 10. Now, you may not agree with his conservative ideology, but this is not what this is about. This is fact-based. And I think he has some interesting comments in this regard about what we see going on in this country and the moral degeneration that has been observed. He quotes Judge Robert Bork. You will remember him. He says, in 1996, he issued a best-selling best-selling denunciation of national decline entitled Slouching Toward Gomorrah. Do you remember that book? Slouching Toward Gomorrah. Some of you may have read it. It says that Judge Bork described the United States as a, quote, degenerate society, is some of the terms he used. Enfeebled, hedonistic, sub-pagan, and headed for the coming of the new dark ages. He urged his readers to take seriously, quoting Bork now, take seriously the possibility that perhaps nothing will be done to reverse the direction of our culture, that the degeneracy we see around us will only become worse. Then Medved quotes from Paul Weyrich, who was the one who coined the phrase, or the term, or the phrase, moral majority. In a letter to his fellow conservatives, he wrote this back in 1999, February of 1999. He said, the culture we are living in becomes an ever wider sewer. In truth, I think we're caught up in a cultural collapse of historic proportions, a collapse so great that it simply overwhelms politics. I no longer believe there is a moral majority. I do not believe that a majority of Americans actually share our values. I believe that we probably have lost the culture war. And then he quotes from John F. MacArthur. Some of you may know of him. He's an influential Christian California pastor. He declared, there comes a point in God's dealing with men and nations. And by the way, MacArthur is not an apocalyptic thinking type person. He's not wild-eyed, the end is near. He doesn't take that approach at all. But he does say this. There comes a point in God's dealing with men and nations, groups of people, when he abandons them. Sin is so rampant in our country, it is so widespread, it is so tolerated by people in leadership and even people in the church. It is so widely tolerated, it is pandemic. It is endemic. That is, it is in the very fabric of our life that I believe God has just taken away the restraining grace and might preserve our nation. That might preserve our nation and has let our nation run to its own doom. And then from some of you remember the name William J. Bennett, the old drug czar, who was previously led the battle against the demons of decadence, as it's called here, as Secretary of Education and drug czar. He published his first index of leading cultural indicators, identifying, quote, substantial social regression. Out of wedlock births had increased by 400%. This is in 1993. This is what Bennett reported in 1993. He says that since 1960, out of wedlock births increased by 400%, violent crime by 500%, and teen suicide by 300%. He concluded that, quote, the forces of social decomposition are challenging and in some instances overtaking decomposition. 1993 is when this was said. And this was fact-based. He was just looking at the information that had been gathered, looking at the stats, and it didn't paint a very pretty picture at all. So does that mean, as some have suggested here, some of these individuals suggested, that we've gone too far, that there's no climbing out of this one, no return? Or, in fact, are we well into a reversal? You wouldn't think so if you look at what's on television, if you consider the things or the smut that's available today. You wouldn't think so. But let me read something else to you here. Medved goes on to say, he quotes the New York Times in late November 2007, bringing it a little closer now to the time we're now in. New York City is on track to have fewer than 500 homicides this year, by far the lowest number in a 12-month period since reliable police department statistics became available in 1963. Better off in New York today than you were back then. But within the city's official crime statistics is a figure that may be even more striking. So far, with roughly half the killings analyzed, only 35 were found to be committed by strangers. A microscopic statistic in a city of more than 8.2 million. If that trend holds up, fewer than 100 homicides in New York City this year will have been strangers to their assailants. In the eyes of some criminologists, the police will be hard-pressed to drive the killing rate much lower, since most killings occur now within the four walls of an apartment or the confines of close relationships. So it's not outsiders coming in, committing these crimes. It happens, you know, within neighborhoods or families. And Medved points out that the trend did hold up, in fact. Throughout 2007, the total of 494 murders were committed in New York City, and well under 100 involved victimizing strangers. That's still a lot, of course, but when you consider the size of that place, consider the past history, it has gotten better in that regard. So what does that tell you about predictions based on? It gives me a clue that things can turn around. And I don't need to be hollering, the end is nigh, the end is nigh. Because things can turn around as we see things turning around. He goes on to say that other major cities may boast less spectacular progress than New York, but nevertheless, and some crime rate has gone up, but overall, it has gone down. gone down. So when you hear those reports, those apocalyptic reports about the escalating crime rates, you say, hold on a minute. You mean back then? They're dropping now. And also he comments on teenage drug use and other such things, even alcohol and so forth. These things too are dropping, believe it or not. They're dropping. Abortions have been steadily declining since 1970s, the 70s, since when they were to reach their peak. And that's not, you know, the politicians like to take credit for that on both sides. You know, like, well, it's due to what I did. But really, it's probably the pro-life crowd that's gotten out there and really worked hard at getting their message across that's had more influence than anything else. And the abortion rate has been steadily declining, as have teenage pregnancies and many other things that he mentions here. And the point is that things are, in many regards, looking better, not worse. There are improvements, not altogether or things going the other direction. There's a turnaround. You have more youth now than ever before committed, making a vow, as it were, a commitment that they're going to remain virgins until marriage. Now, you know, all of them are not going to keep that promise, but many of them are keeping it. So even though there are forces at work in this country and in this world that would take us away from biblical moral values, there is, make no mistake about it, there is a strong, strong resistance. And things are going the other direction to some extent, to a measurable extent, in fact. We do live in a time when, within elite institutions, there is an effort to overturn, as I said, traditional values. But again, we have a strong resistance. The point is, what was thought to be irreversible is already. In many ways, things are better today than they were a few years ago, as I said. And again, this tells me that it is possible to predict total moral, it is not possible to predict total moral collapse on the basis of the trends you see going on at the time, because they very well may change within a relatively short time, as they did from the 90s to the present time. The prophecy lesson for us, I think, is simple and timeless, and it's this. No matter what you see going on around you, you never drop your guard. You never take off your armor. You move right along. Things get better, so much the better. That's great. Things get worse, you keep on watching. That is to say, you keep on being vigilant. You remain in a state of preparedness at all times, because you don't know the day of His coming. You may see the signs, or you may see that fig tree to put forth blooms, or you may think it's about to put forth blooms, when in fact, false start yet. Or putting it in our terms, decades. We simply don't know. The lesson for us is, when we look at prophecy, we're not looking for things that we can point out to tell people what's going to happen. We're looking at these things from the point of view of the prophets themselves. And say, this is what's going to happen, and I want you to know about it, and there's nothing you can do about it. That nothing you can do about it part was never a part of the message. In fact, within the message, central to the message was, there is something you can do about it. You can turn from your sins. You can repent. You can turn to God. You can improve things. You know, to me, that's a much more positive message than, well, it's old and we know eventually it will. But I would much rather be preaching a message, be involved in a message of repentance and remission of sins and giving people hope, not only for the world to come, but even for the world now. I know I'm not going to change, we are not going to change the whole world, but we can change the lives of a lot of people. And who knows, we might even change the lives of enough people that'll make a difference in our community. And if that's the case, maybe enough people will change over time that'll make a difference in our country. Isn't that what the job of a prophet or a watchman really is? Is to call people to repentance? You know, that's the real central meaning, the central purpose of prophecy. It's not merely to tell us what's going to happen. It's to tell us why it's going to happen. And the message, of course, is that you have something to do with why it's going to happen. Therefore, repent. Turn back to God. Rely on Him. And if we do that, then I think we would see a continued reversal of the moral decline that we've been watching. I think we would see a continued reversal in all the negative things that are going on in this country. Ultimately, we'd see more and more people going back to God, and we'd live in a very different society. We're thankful already for the one we have. I think it could get even eventually get worse.